privacy technologies. And in my talk today, I like to combine my two favorite research topics, which are economics and privacy. And I will try to show what economics can say about privacy, and even more importantly, what it can tell technologies like you, who build privacy technology or security technologies, in terms of how we can build them in a way that users actually deploy them. That's why the tagline of my talk, "Why Protecting Privacy is Easy but Selling is Not," is a little bit of a provocation. Obviously, it's not that easy. Talk before me by Roger showed how much work goes into developing privacy solutions. However, the question is, why do we have indeed really, really cool technologies that almost nobody uses? Apart from this kind of audience and the kind of people who come to Black Hat, very few people have actually started using the many tools we have. So why is that happening? And why is that happening while at the same time people claim to be very concerned about privacy? So Bill Clinton used to have apparently this line on his desk, "It's the economy is stupid," referring to the economy as the source of any problem, and possibly the solution to the problem too. And I would argue that this applies to privacy as well. Although I'm not claiming that privacy is only about monetary compensation. Privacy is about moral right and freedom. However, privacy is also about trade-offs. The trade-offs between revealing or hiding your personal information. And these are trade-offs both for the single individual, but also for the organizations which deal with these individuals, and have to find a balance between their need to know the consumer and gain as much possible information about them, and not annoy them with intrusive privacy policies. And obviously economics is the real trade-off. So what I will try to do today is, in the very first part of my talk, sort of the educational part, describe the history, recent history, but still quite interesting history of economics and privacy, and the economics of privacy. In the second part, I will actually focus on what I believe are the most interesting questions, open questions nowadays. And in the last part, we present some of my most recent research in this area about theoretical economic models trying to explain user behavior in terms of privacy, and some preliminary results from surveys and experiments I'm running. So let's start with privacy and economy, economics and privacy. I start here with a quote from one of the founding fathers, John Adams, 1761, saying, "I'm under no moral or other obligation to publish to the world how much my expenses and my incomes amount to yearly. Dissimulation is a branch of wisdom." So, as you know, the founding fathers were actually very much concerned about privacy, and if you see the history of how the Declaration of Independence was written, there was important issues about anonymity already at the time. But it was not an issue simply of protection, it was also an economic issue. And in fact, in the history of privacy, intrusions in privacy protection, you often find an economic element. So the first American census in 1799 was not done simply because the government wanted to know its citizens, but because it wanted to tax them. And the first resistance to the census was also based on economic reasons. Certain states did not want to be taxed. In 1890, when what would become Judge Brandeis and Warren, two attorneys in Boston at the time, wrote a very seminal article on privacy, the article which had the line that privacy is the right to be left alone. Well, again, there was an economic problem there. The problem was that magazines and publications were becoming more and more commercial entities, selling more and more copies based on gossip. And some of this gossip was about the upper class in Boston, which therefore affected Warren Brandeis, and were answering to this new commercial need, which was exploiting personal information. Similarly, in 1901, a very nice story told by Ellie Smith in his book about this Franklin Mills flower girl, one of the first cases of exploitation of somebody's personal image. Apparently, this girl, Abby Dabby, was a particularly pretty, beautiful lady who this company took her image and printed it out on 25,000 flyers to advertise their flower, Miss Flower company, without offering any compensation. And this was one of the first trials done against the company appropriating somebody else's image or personal information. Social Security number, when the administration in the 45 started them, well, there was an economic need for them. There was a need to create a system which would allow citizens to send money while they were working to a fund and then get them back after they were not employed any longer. And then there are, again, economic reasons why the SSN, from being an identification number, became an authentication device, which was obviously a horrible mistake, is what is causing all the problem we have in the US in terms of identity theft. But it was an economic problem in the sense that it was simply easy to use that number, not only for the identification, but also for authentication. Retail credit company and TRW. How many of you have heard about these two companies? Has anybody in this room? Okay, this is a particularly interesting audience because when I've talked about these companies before, almost nobody knows them. But when I show Equifax and Experian, many people recognize these companies. And Retail Credit and TRW in the 70s and 80s had to change their corporate name because of so much bad PR they had accumulated over the years because of their privacy intrusive policies in dealing with personal information and credit card information, or generally speaking, credit information. And then, of course, we reached the internet days and stories we all know about, Amazon doing price discrimination based on cookies information, real audio, putting tracking device in the real player, eToys changing its privacy policies, and so on. In fact, there was a period around 1999-2000 when privacy seemed to be the big deal. All magazines were having articles in them, cover pages, discussing how you had to protect yourself, how everybody was concerned, and many companies were starting this period, in the period, including mine. And then something different happened. The forecast in around 2001 was that by 2004 we would have reached $450 billion dollar B2C transaction volume. Actually, in 2001, what happened was, well, September 11, and what also happened was the crisis of .com and the failure of many startups, many venture capitalists getting their funds away from .coms. So also privacy became much less of a problem. In fact, the market, under pressure, reacted with even more intrusive privacy policies. You may remember that Yahoo, in around 2000, changed the privacy policies on its Yahoo mail account so they could start receiving advertising email. And this is a typical behavior of a company under pressure. And we will see this pattern repeating in the rest of this talk. So in the fight between privacy protective technologies, which were coming up in the period, and companies instead based on data marketing, on gathering consumer data, well, the latter were definitely winning. A good example is the anonymous payments market. There was a period when so many companies were trying to fight in this market. It was probably the best technology of all, eCash, based on David Chaum blind signature scheme. There was my own company, BigGuardian. There were companies like iPrivacy, Private Buy, with different third-party models, we buy it for you kind of models. Well, basically, all those companies based on pure anonymity disappeared pretty quickly, or maybe they still nominally survive, but actually with zero market share. What did the law do? Did it try to address the privacy problem? Well, not really. In 2002, there was this, it was not an hoax, it was this funny message sent on a Polytech list, Declan McCulloch, saying that the National Zoo in Washington had refused to release a deceased giraffe medical records on grounds that it would violate the animal right to privacy. So people started even joking about a ape act, animal privacy entitlement. That was a joke. What was not a joke is that rather than an ape act, we got the Patriot Act, which is not really a privacy protecting kind of law. So what would economic say about this? And this is what I'm going to talk now, because there's been a a very interesting change in the approach of economics to privacy in the last 20 years. In the beginning, the first people explicitly talking of the economics of privacy were Chicago school economists, so neoclassical economists, like Posner and Stigler. And they were saying that, you see, privacy as concealment of information is indeed the focus of economists. But privacy as quiet, the term that Posner says to refer to the fact that, for example, a manager in a company is higher ranking. So he has the right to privacy, in the sense he has the right to have his own office so he can be more productive. Well, yeah, that has a little bit of economic relevance, but not much. And then all the issue of privacy is freedom, no economic relevance whatsoever. 1980, Chicago School. What we have now instead in the literature which came out in the last, particularly in the last 4 years, is economists trying to address even this strange, difficult, and beautiful topic of privacy as freedom. So again, I go back to what I mentioned in the beginning. Although economists don't try to monetize freedom, nevertheless, they try to create a framework where you understand what kind of trade-offs, imbalances you face when revealing or hiding, protecting your personal information. So let me go a little more in deep into this evolution, because I guess there will be some interesting historical facts coming out of this. As I mentioned, in the early 80s, there was this Chicago School approach, and I will discuss further Stigler and Posner. Then in the middle 90s, because of the growth of information technology, and in particular security technology, encryption, security technologies was so important, economists started discussing issues of secondary use of personal information, encrypting data, and so on. So Alverian, Elinoran, Kenneth Loudon, Richard Clerk started writing. And then after 2001, we had a new change, what I was mentioning earlier, the fact that with the internet, something became possible which was not before. Global, real-time interaction between individual consumer and individual sellers through the internet, through computers, so that each seller could target particular services or even change the price according to, for example, cookies found on a user computer without really being physically there, but through a computer. This led to lots of interest in modeling, theoretical modeling in economics, and also a new interest in surveys and empirical analysis, which I will talk about. And also led to a new area of economics, which is now the economics of privacy, personal information security. Ross Anderson, I believe a gentleman you all know, had this paper in, I believe it was 2001, on why information security is hard, combining economics and information security, and together with Alverian started this workshop of economics of information security, WACE, which is now in the third edition, and is attracting the work of both security professionals and economists. So let me deal with this chronology and discussing some of the ideas which came up over the years and how they evolved. So I was mentioning that Stigler and Posner were some of the first economists dealing with privacy, and you will see how their views are quite dramatically different from what the view is now. So Stigler would say that, I'm about to say something that probably in this audience will be anathema, but he would say that the ownership of information does not belong to the party that information refers to. It belongs to the party which invested resources into obtaining it. So if American Express spent money developing databases to track your behavior and sells it away, it's right. Because the information is not yours. Your name is not yours. Your name in the database is of the company which spent money into that database. This is the sort of Chicago view. And therefore, the next step, logical step, is that the free exchange of information will actually lead to desirable results regardless of who actually owns the data. Because imagine that you are a good debtor, so you have a good credit record, then you want this information to be known by everybody, so you can get a better mortgage rate. If you are a bad debtor, instead you try to hide it, you try to protect it, you try to protect your privacy under this kind of view. Which means that when you are a bad debtor, either you reveal this information and you will get a bad rate, or you do not reveal this information. You try to protect this information. But if you protect this information, you are giving away the fact that you are a bad debtor. so you're lost. Obviously, one can make many counter-arguments to this. For example, the fact that one could have an interest in privacy protection beyond the issue of being a good or bad debtor. You could be a very good debtor, and you would still like not to give away your personal information. And or also, there could be technology which could help achieving both goals at the same time, having a good credit market and still privacy protection. But those ideas were not yet in the literature then. The ideas in the literature then were about the free flow of information. The dominant mantra in economics is that information has to flow so that we reach economic efficiency. And so also was Posner, 1980. Privacy as concealment of information is about, again, individuals with bad traits, for example, poor employees, trying to hide in them. Instead, individuals with good traits have an interest in showing them. So reducing information available, for example, to employers causes inefficiency in the market. And Posner even extends this analysis to extra market behavior such as marriage. If you have a good trait to be a good wife or a good husband, you want to show it. If you want to be private about certain aspect of your past, it means that you will be bad in a marriage. In fact, if you conceal information, then the cost will be borne by others. A typical example, and a good example, although extreme, is sex offenders. So should databases about sex offenders exist and be made public? As you know, in the UK and the US, the approach is completely different about whether there is a right to privacy of a former sex offender who now could no longer be a potential criminal, or whether instead the need of the society or the community where the former sex offender lives is so strong that you want the information to be revealed. And the position in Posner is that, no doubt, this information must be shown. There is no right to privacy there, because the cost will be borne by others. So if you protect privacy, Posner concludes, you will have redistribution and inefficiency. Redistribution meaning that the allocation of money will go from the right party to the wrong party. Things started changing, as I was mentioning, in the mid-90s, when there were developments in information technology, and in particular in information security. Eli Noam at Columbia University started analyzing economic value of encryption. First of all, he said that assuming that there are no transaction costs in trading or negotiating personal information, the initial assignments of information rights is arbitrary from the viewpoint of economic efficiency. For those of you who have done economics before, this may remind you of the Coase theorem, that the initial ownership of a certain right is actually does not have an impact on how you will end eventually in the long term, because the party who has the highest interest in the information in adopting it or protecting it will be the party who will be willing to pay the most. So eventually you will be in an efficient equilibrium. And he makes the case of encryption, saying that what encryption does, and this maybe is again another anathema or blasphemy for this kind of audience, is not really determining who, whether somebody will have access to information or not. It's actually determining who will pay more for certain information, in the sense that if you encrypt your data, now you have a stronger tool to sell your data away. Because if it's more difficult for others to access it, it means that the parties who need the information, who want it, will have to pay more. Therefore, encryption makes other parties pay and can redistribute wealth back to consumers. So it's an interesting view. It's already an evolution from the early days, 1980s days, of the economics of privacy. However, Eli Noam also admits that there are some difficulties in these arguments, especially incomplete information, which is a very important topic. I will go back later on in my talk. The fact that you don't always know how much technology is out there, how many risks there are out there, how you can protect yourself from those risks. Human right, the fact that privacy is also a moral right for many of us. And the burden on the poor, the people who cannot access certain technologies. So more or less in the period also, Alvayan, UC Berkeley, started considering how consumers rationally may want certain information to be available to producers, but not other kinds. For example, you may want the seller to know what kind of goods you like so that he only targets advertising for what you possibly will enjoy, but not how much, because otherwise it will price discriminate you. And the annoyance sometimes comes from too little information being shared. Consider spam. Spam is the best example of untargeted mail, because you receive stuff you would never buy. So it's an annoyance. But if advertising is targeted, some economists claim, well, that wouldn't be such a problem, because it actually is providing you a service. There are externalities, however, when information is diffused past the party you deal with. So secondary use of personal information. You lose control on the personal information. It goes away to many others. And again, Valiant tries to propose a property right approach to privacy, which is also an idea Kenneth Loudon also described in a 96 ACM communications paper, about trying to give ownership, legal ownership of personal data to individual users so that they can sell that right away. And then another jump, this is the last phase of economics of privacy, which is the most recent. As it happens many times, many people start working on the same idea at the same time. So in 2001, there were three working papers which came out literally a few weeks away each from the other. Katsulari and Pavan about merchants selling data about consumers to each other, when this is good for consumers, when this is bad. Curtis Taylor studying a similar problem. And then myself and Alvarian studying how companies use cookies for price discrimination, and under what condition this could actually be good for consumer, if ever. Well, what comes out, and from them on, lots of other new models, technical models came out. The economics of privacy now is growing quite fast. There are lots of new interesting models coming out. What was coming out from this new approach to modeling privacy was something interesting. A little surprising. When you use pure economic modeling, it turns out that, well, cookies could actually sometimes make the consumer better off. It could involve price discrimination, like in the Amazon case, but sometimes this is compensated by the benefits you get in terms of personalization, one-click checkout, and so on. Share information with your sellers, again, could be beneficial sometimes to the consumer, because it reduces what economists call the market distortions. And again, with strategic consumers, sometimes firms are better off just protecting with a self-regulation approach, protecting the privacy of the consumer. So what is the problem? It looks like economic laws are saying that, well, everybody will be happy and privacy will be protected and only the good amount of information will be shared. Well, the problem is that when economists talk about agents, they only focus on agents as this abstract entity which has taste and preference for goods. To go back to a technology naming, what could be called the online identity. Who you are online when you use a pseudonym. Say that you log on Amazon.com with a Mickey Mouse at Hotmail account. Nobody knows your real identity until the moment when you actually pay with your credit card and your Mickey Mouse at Hotmail account is associated with what is your offline identity. So what economics is saying is that economic rules would tend to allow the right balance of information being shared for what refers to online identity. The information you like to share because it maybe helps you to get a better service, targeted recommendation, and so on. The problem is that, most current technologies, if not all of them, link online and offline identities. So in the case of Amazon, there is no way to use eCash on Amazon. You have to use your credit card, and your online account will be correlated with your offline identity. However, technology can separate them. This is precisely what information security technology, privacy, anonymity technologies do. So why this is not happening? Why don't we have eCash being offered as a payment solution together with Visa, MasterCard, and American Express on Amazon.com? So this is the second part of the talk. There are so many interesting questions open. One is whether is too much privacy is bad for you, as some people claim, because they say that we need sharing information. It's inescapable to make the information technology society work. Whether we really have zero privacy, so we have lost already the game, there is no way out. What are the real costs of privacy if you don't protect yourself? Who should protect your privacy? Yourself, the companies you deal with, the government? And do people really care about privacy? And all of them also affect the question I was asking earlier. While we have great technologies to unlink online and offline identity, but they did not succeed in the market. So let's start with the first question. Is too much privacy bad for you? Some people make the argument, including some economists, that too much privacy can act against the interests of society or the individual. The argument of Posner and Stigler was exactly this, that too much privacy creates inefficiency because people with bad traits will have their bad traits hidden so that the other party will not know in advance who is facing. But actually economics says, as I just said, that you can have the best of the two worlds because you can share certain information and hide other information. You can share your taste if you want to, and you can protect your social security number, credit card number. Again, this is not always completely easy. So in a world where we leave so many trails of personal information in every instant, it is possible to connect these trails, find linkages through them, and the anonymity set, to use a term by Danesis and Sergentov, shrinks. So even with privacy technology, it's still difficult to hide all your traces. But nevertheless, we do have very good technology. So although Scott McNeil's son in, I guess around 2000, 2001, said, get over it, you're already zero privacy, well, we know that we can unlink information. We can protect privacy. And although one could claim that if we live in a society where we have constantly GPS on us or RFID tags everywhere, we are leaving so many trails around that it's impossible to provide privacy against a global attacker who can access all the different data set, well, the answer from an economist would be, yes, that is technically correct, but the goal is not to make it possible. The goal is make the work of the attacker costly enough that the value of your personal information will not compensate the cost the attacker has to face in order to penetrate your security levels. And that can be done. We have amazing technologies to protect privacy in almost every conceivable scenario. We have technologies for anonymous payments. And again, I believe one of the best ones is David Chalmers eCash, based on his blind signature protocol. We have great technologies for anonymous browsing, and Roger Dingleding was presenting this morning a very cool one. We have technologies for sharing your preferences in a private way. We have technologies for emailers, OnionNet, Chao MixNet for anonymous messaging. We have good electronic voting, and instead the electronic voting we use is very bad DRE machines. So what is happening? Well, again, what is happening, I believe, is that the economic argument shows that you could have trade-offs between sharing and hiding reconciled together. Technology can do it. They didn't do it together. Well, the problem is that there are so many parties that you have to satisfy. You have to find a privacy combination which is convenient for the consumer, profitable for the vendor. I'm taking here the case of an anonymous payment technology. Profitable for the vendor, advantageous for existing other players, for example, legacy applications, and non-replicable by competitors. So who should take the lead on this? Should it be self-regulation? Should it be the companies? Should it be the government? Should it be yourself? Well, the companies, the approach of self-regulation tends to fail under pressure. The Yahoo case is just one example, but many companies could have adopted privacy-enhancing technologies, for example, anonymous payments like eCash, which could have also reduced their credit card frauds ratio. They did not, for many reasons, including the risk of embarking a technology which doesn't have a huge market yet. So the risk of being the first bringing over the innovation. Legislation, as you know, the EU and the US, European Union and the US have a completely different approach. In the European Union, we have a privacy directive, strong, overarching, not sectorial. So it's about data protection for all different parties. And in the US, instead, there is a very localized, segmented approach. There are maybe laws to protect video store rentals, but there is maybe no law to protect your social security number. And it's still open, the debate on what is the best model. But many people, and here I'm quoting an authority, Pamela Samuelson, would argue that the American model is not working. The main objection being the social cost of confusing privacy policies. If you go to privacy and law conferences and workshops, you realize that even the experts cannot agree on what is protected and what is not, because there are so many levels in the American system, from the Supreme Court to state constitution, the American Constitution itself, which doesn't mention privacy explicitly, but has been interpreted in certain, for certain amendments as to protect privacy, down to the level of maybe federal regulations. There are so many, sometimes conflicting approaches that even the experts don't know what is allowed, what is not. And if the expert do not know it, how we can be imagine that the user would know what is the risk and what is not. So can individual responsibility work? Should we ourselves protect our privacy by using the technologies that people like you develop? And should also we, because it's actually expensive or costly not to do so? Well, this is what I'm going to discuss in the rest of the talk, and I'll try to bring both my modeling on this and some empirical data I started gathering recently on this topic. But I will start by framing this question in a slightly different way. I'm quoting here from again, another Polytech message. This was about the Google Mail debate that I'm sure all of you heard about, the potential privacy risk of Google Mail. And Declan McCullough writes, it is true that there are potential costs of using Gmail for email storage. The question is whether consumers should have the right to make the choice and balance the trade-offs, or whether it will be preemptively denied to them by privacy fundamentalists out to deny consumers the choice. And my question is, well, is it really true that we consumers are able to make the choice? And I would try to argue no, not in the sense that we are dumb and we cannot protect ourselves, but in the sense that privacy is almost an insolvable problem from the individual perspective. And I'll try to show you why I try to argue this from an economic perspective. Let's start from something which came out in the 2001, when privacy was a big deal for everybody. There were all sorts of surveys and experiments showing that everybody was concerned about privacy. Everybody would say, this is the top reason why I don't go online. I would use more the internet if I had more privacy. I don't buy online because I feel my privacy is not protected enough. I would buy more if there was a tool, some guarantee for my privacy, and so on. The behavior was completely different. There is anecdotal evidence, and there is the famous Austin Hale Big Mac joke. Ask 100 people whether they are concerned about their privacy or not. 85 of them will say yes. Ask the same 100 people whether they will give away their DNA for a Big Mac, and 85 people will say yes again. And this was a joke, but actually was confirmed quite accurately by a series of experiments, starting with this one, 2001, Spiekermann, Groslax, and Berndt, University of Berlin. They had this really cool experiment where they had around 450 people, so good sample size, writing down what were their personal preference with respect to privacy, and then they clustered them according to whether they were privacy fundamentalists, privacy pragmatic, and people who don't care at all about privacy. And then they started offering them discounts for digital cameras on pieces of clothing in exchange of personal information. And it turned out that even the privacy fundamentalists were more than happy to give away the personal data just for a little discount. It's amazing how little this discount could be. Other studies published in the New York Times have shown that sometimes people come up with this number, like with $5 is enough to for convince a person to give away social security number. There was the study you probably heard about, InfoSec Europe, about the password for chocolate. This kind of things happen. Some is anecdotal evidence, some are real experiments. I would say the death of most .com which were trying to push for privacy technology and sell them is a good confirmation and proof of this dichotomy between attitude and behavior. So what is causing this dichotomy? And the workshop on economics and information security I was mentioning earlier in 2003 had some very, very interesting paper which generated lots of debate and made me think a lot. One hypothesis was Paul Silverstone. He wrote that it's a rational decision anyway, because really, even if somebody knows your DNA, what could be the big deal? If you consider the expected negative value, the damage, expected damage you will have from that is so little that it's better you get a big Mac right now. And then there was Adam Shostak, who came out with a very, very interesting point. He said that people actually pay for privacy, at least in some cases. For example, shades on window. That's a form of privacy technology. You don't want to be observed by your neighbor when you are in your kitchen or your bedroom. So people pay when it matters to them. Uberman, more recently, talked about privacy and deviance. You really care about privacy when you feel that your behavior or your trait is deviant from the norm of the community you belong to. So take weight, how heavy or how light you are. If you are in the upper or lower layers of the largest or slimmest, you will tend to protect your personal information about how much you weigh more than the people in the median area. Nice experiment. Well, I, especially based on Adam and working from there, I started working on some explanation based on what behavioral economists call the immediate gratification bias. However, to explain that, I have to take a step back and first say why privacy is so complicated and at the same time so exciting for an economist. First of all, because privacy, which is the other side of the coin of personal information, is a peculiar economic good. It is dominated by asymmetric information. When you reveal personal information, you do not know how often, by whom it will be used later on, because your information can be diffused many, many times after you revealed it the first times. In a wireless society, these intrusions become ubiquitous, continuous, and invisible. You don't even realize how much information you are revealing in every instant. So there are externalities and moral hazard, because the other parties can cause you damage, and maybe you don't even know them. You never interacted with them. They got your information from somebody else. And their transaction affect you, but they don't incorporate this externality in their calculations. The value of privacy, furthermore, can only be calculated ex post, in the sense that you can say that you only realize how privacy is important when you lose it. That's the moment when you realize how much you should have protected, and it's too late. So it's a good whose value you cannot really determine in advance. So a very difficult good to treat in modeling. Because it keeps on affecting, positively or negative, the individual way longer after the transaction has been completed. You reveal your information once, and maybe you get a lump sum, the $5 discount, the chocolate for your password, but maybe the economic damage that you are subject to that keeps on going and increasing over time from that moment on. The value of privacy of the personal information is also context dependent, in the sense that I go back to this concept of anonymity sets. We constantly reveal information about ourselves that people can link. So two pieces of data about myself, maybe my name and the fact that I'm here in this moment in this room, well, alone could have zero value or zero damage on me. But maybe connected by somebody could create some kind of privacy intrusion. This is impossible to predict in advance because it depends on how you are recombining the information, how you are recollecting and reconnecting this different information. Again, this is very difficult for individual consumers to deal with. And then it's very subjective because there are not only economic monetary consequences, but there is, of course, as I mentioned, the issue of the moral right to privacy, the privacy as freedom. And then again, some other further complications. Privacy has the nature of what economists call both public and private good. A public good for an economist is a good that is non-rival and non-excludable, which means that you use it, but other people can use it at the same time. So defense, military defense is a public good, right? Because everybody is protected by that. The fact that I'm protected by military defense does not decrease your level of protection. Information normally is non-excludable, so if I give away my personal information to you, I can give it to A, B, C, D, many other people. So this is as a public good nature. At the same time, it's very private, because if I give my information to A, B, C, and D, A, B, C, and D could harm myself later on in time. So there is this kind of, economic schizophrenic, dual nature of privacy. And again, buy versus sell value. Individuals value differently protection and sale of the same piece of information. They could say that they would pay $5 to protect it, but they would ask maybe $10 to sell it away. So we all have different attitudes in terms of protecting or giving away. And this is because, effectively, the market for personal information and the market for privacy are two different markets. They tend to be mixed together, but they actually involve different psychological and thinking mechanisms. In one market, the information is public, in the other is private. In one market is about selling, the other market is about buying the ownership to protect your own data. One market is specific. Do you give your credit card information to Amazon? The other is generic. Are you generically privacy concerned? One market is about the value that the people put on your personal information, what is valuable to them so that they want to access it. The other is the damage that if you reveal your personal information, you will suffer maybe 1 year from now. As I said, one market is about a lump sum that you get when you give away some data, and the other is the negative damage you will keep on accumulating over time. How this go back to the point I was making of us as individual consumers having true difficulties in dealing with our own privacy? Well, this is the point. Economists normally tend to model consumers as rational agents. They are forward-looking, which means they look into the future. They know the consequences of their actions now, later on. They are utility maximizers. They want to maximize their personal utility. Bayesian updaters, they gather information on the way, and through that they update their views on the world. And they are perfectly informed. They either know everything, or when they know everything, they still can process all the information they have and make the best solution out of that. And this is what dominates both the empirical and the theoretical work on privacy. Now, consider what the typical trade-off that somebody faces when dealing with privacy. If you decide to protect your privacy in a certain scenario, normally you have an immediate cost because maybe you have to use a certain privacy technology, which either you have to pay for, or maybe it delays. The CNN.com page will download in 2.7 seconds rather than just half a second. The cost could be monetary, could be immaterial, and so on. Or the cost could be the loss of immediate benefit because you are protecting your privacy and maybe you are not getting that $5 discount that drugstore.com is offering to you. On the other side, the benefit is only in the future and uncertain. The benefit could be an absence of maybe privacy intrusion 1 year from now, the absence of identity theft, which is a sort of false negative. You really don't know whether the protection you spend resources on now is really what saved you later, because the absence of the attack is not approved by itself. On the other side, if you decide not to protect, you have immediate benefits sometimes because you give away information, you get a discount, say. And the future, uncertain costs, because maybe you get lucky. Nothing better will happen to you. You cannot give your DNA to everybody. Nothing will happen. So we human beings have problems in dealing with these kind of trade-offs. And the three levels of problems I focused on are, one, incomplete information, two, bounded rationality, and three, psychological and behavioral distortions. And if you are interested in the actual mathematical modeling, there is a paper on ACM, electronic commerce proceedings. And if you are interested in the empirical analysis, which is ongoing, I'll be presenting some preliminary data, there is this workshop, Economics of Information Security, paper with Jens Grosslax. Let me say something about this. So, incomplete information, what I was mentioning earlier, we actually have no control. We cannot really predict what is the risk of revealing a certain piece of information. There are so many possible consequences, so many ramifications of where the information could end up, which even the expert don't know how we as individual consumers can predict, which means, again, that we have the issue of asymmetric information. The other party knows how we use our information. We don't. There are material, immaterial costs. There are uncertain, exposed evaluation, what I was mentioning earlier, which means very difficult to actually act under complete information. But let's assume that magically we add, in fact, some complete information about all possible risk and all possible protection. Well, there is still a problem, which is what economist Herbert Simon and Nobel Prize Herbert Simon called bounded rationality. The fact that we human beings are not computers who can process all the information available. when we are about to make a purchase online, we don't take out a calculator and start calculating complex statistics based on some distribution functions about what is the risk of revealing this piece of data now. We rather use empirics. Our band rationality, the fact that we don't have unbounded processing power, means that we'll just take shortcuts. We will not use all the information available. And we couldn't, really. There is so many there are so many stochastic events affecting this, and the Health Privacy Protection the Health Privacy Act is a good example of this. Of the so many there are so many ramifications about so many different parties could access your health data, and sometimes the paradox is that sometimes you would want them to access your data because it could happen. I was at a workshop a couple of weeks ago, and a doctor was talking about this problem of selecting complete protection when you have to sign the act when you go to a medical service provider. The unintended consequence could be that one day, if you are in an emergency room, a doctor could not access, would not have the right to access certain information which could be crucial to know at the moment. For example, life or death. I think it's a good point. The person who was talking at the Portia workshop is actually a doctor who works on privacy, and I took him as the authority on this point. I'm interested in this remark. Thank you for the remark. And although, imagine that again, you have complete information, you could have complete information, and let's imagine that you could also have unbounded power to process all this information. Well, there is still a third layer of problems and obstacles between you and privacy protection. And this is what behavioral psychologists and behavioral economists call psychological distortions. Consider, for example, optimism bias. Most of us tend to think that the bad events will happen to the other guy. So we know that there is a certain risk of, say, dying a certain activity, but we always believe it's not us. We tend to discount that risk. Or complacency towards large risk. There is a vast body of literature about how when a risk is really huge and it's really scary, a natural tendency of the human brain is actually to discount it, to refuse it, refuse to think about that. This is why, for example, some advertising in the 80s and early 90s about HIV, which tried to scare people showing what the bad, horrible consequences of HIV could be, were not having the effect they were meant to have, because people were so scared that they would decide not to act. It's a form of psychological dissonance. And this can also hold in privacy. The risk of identity theft for some people can be so huge that you prefer not to think about that and not to protect yourself. Or sometimes the argument can be the opposite. Sometimes we have, again, this is proved by behavioral psychology literature, we have problems in dealing with small risks which accumulate over time. Take smokers. Smokers are aware of the risk of cancer related to smoking. However, studies have shown that the problem is associating each single cigarette, which per se has maybe a minimal effect, but over time accumulating, combined, bring this huge risk of developing cancer. The same thing relates to privacy, because each single action per se may not be that risky. But many actions and many traces of data connected together become a huge liability. Coherent arbitrariness, the fact that sometimes when we made a bad choice, we stick to it. So if we reveal personal information once, maybe we keep on revealing it again and again, because we did an arbitrary choice, but we become coherent in this arbitrariness. Hot-cold theory, we tend to think we act in a certain way, but we really act differently. So when we are asked in theory in the cold situation, would you give away your passport for chocolate? You say no. If you are in a hot situation where you offer something, you may react differently. And then the argument I like the most, hyperbolic discount, which is economic jargon, also known as immediate gratification. Let me show you something which is somewhat about economic or immediate gratification. There is Dilbert meeting Cuthbert, the evil evil director of human resources, and who says your 401k retirement plan will be replaced with a 401a plan. A stands for afterlife. You will get no money in this life, but the company will reward you in the afterlife. The odds of that happening seem low, Dilbert says. And Cutbear answers, yes, but on an expected value basis, a high potential reward compensates for low odds. So he's using the concept of expected utility. For example, how many free software upgrades would I need to promise you in the afterlife to make you work yourself to death this year? 70 version. And then Dilbert goes back home and talks with, I guess that's Dogbert? Dogbert. And he says, I resisted his charisma, but he got me with his math. And the analytical side of this is the following. Now, these are a few slides where I'm going to use a little bit of economic jargon, but I'll try also to use some numerical example which will make it clear. Who has heard before the concept of utility and maximizing utility from an economic perspective? Anybody in this room? One? Few people, okay. U is normally used by economists to represent utility, the utility you receive from a certain action. The standard discounting model of utility is exponential, which means that you discount future utility in an exponential way. Having $1 tomorrow is more valuable than having $1 in 1 year from now, and so on. However, in the 1980s, 1990s, some economists started proposing a different model, hyperbolic discounting, when there is a parameter, beta, added to the question, which says that apart from this exponential discounting factor, you also have an additional parameter, which says how much you look into the future. For example, if beta is zero, it means that as a human being, you don't care at all about what happens tomorrow. When beta is one, the model is exactly the same as the normal discounting model. What is an example of this hyperbolic discounting? Working. Most of us are procrastinators. We know that we should better work now, finish that paper, prepare that submission now, rather than postpone it to next weekend, but we keep on doing that. So we penalize our future self in favor of our current self, even when this on an expected value basis will make no sense, because actually if we postpone, we could end up even working more, working under more panic and suffering even more. How does this apply to privacy? Well, it applies in explaining both the dichotomy between what people claim in surveys and what they do in actual behavior, and also to explain why certain privacy technologies are used and others are not. I give an example here. Let's imagine that you want to minimize the expected negative utility that you will receive from certain privacy intrusions. And you have two options. X is a dummy variable which represents whether you are going to protect yourself and X is 1, or not protect yourself and X is 0. So when you decide to protect yourself and X is 1, you will have in the future, this is survey time, people ask you, would you protect yourself if there is a privacy technology that you can use? People will say, we consider the expected cost of protection and time the discount factor, and we compare it to instead the cost of a privacy intrusion, maybe later on, 5 months after the survey, and we may decide whether to protect the self or not. If you ask the same question, not a survey time, but asking, okay, do you want now to pay for a privacy technology or face the risk, the future risk? Well, I can prove, and in the extended paper I show, that you will be able to, without changing anything in the valuations and in the numbers, some people who claimed honestly to be concerned about privacy and wanting to protect themselves will not. Because of hyperbolic discounting and immediate gratification, when they were at the time asked, would you in the future protect yourself against future privacy intrusions, they would say yes. But when it comes the moment, okay, do it now, protect yourself now against privacy intrusions, they will say no, which is what is possible in these two equations. The extended versions is in the papers I was mentioning, and there are some numerical examples that I think about skipping. The bottom line here is, actually, this is first a question for the gentleman at the very end of the room. I don't remember whether you told me it's till 12:15 or 12:30.
12:30.
Thank you. The consequences of this modeling is that you have the irrationality model is not appropriate to describe privacy behavior. In fact, you have time inconsistencies, which may lead to under protection and over release of personal information, even by individuals who are actually honestly concerned about their own privacy. And interestingly, in the extended version of the model, you can show that even sophisticated users will fall by the same mistake. So even users like you will fall the same mistakes because of an interesting logical argument. You basically predict that there will be one day when you will not be able to protect yourself because you cannot protect yourself always. Because you predict already that you will fail, you start failing now. It becomes irrational approach. And this also leads to large risk accumulating over small steps. So not knowing the risk is not the issue. It's not simply that you don't care. There is something more hardcore into our brains about the way we deal with these problems. And then, so far, I was considering only specific dilemmas, specific issues about privacy intrusions, privacy protection. Let me consider the big picture. When you consider many possible privacy intrusions. So, okay, this is like the model of all chart. This will become very crowded, but I will go step by step, and if I miss any link and if anything is not clear, please ask me. So what I'm trying to show here is how things change when you go from the single intrusion to considering how many intrusions you can face in your lifetime. So there is this, these two axes. There is the cost that you will incur from defending your privacy or from having your privacy invaded on the y-axis, and on the x-axis we have the privacy protective activities you decide to engage into. So even non-economists have heard the concept of marginal decrease in utility. Every good that you like eventually gives you marginal decrease in marginal utility because, you know, the first Coke you drink is good, the second is still okay, the third Coke is really not that good, and on and on and on. Same thing for privacy, in the sense that the cost increase. In the lower part of the chart, well, there is the very basic minimal things you can do to protect your privacy. For example, not checking out that you're not putting your social security number on your CV. Okay, these are basic things which don't take time. They are not really costly to do. Up on the other layer, there are the more difficult activities, say, join the Zero Knowledge Freedom Network that you have to pay for, so only certain people do. Well, let's say that these technologies are effective. So indeed, the more you protect yourself, let's say that the lower is the expected cost of privacy intrusions. This is just an hypothesis, because we really don't know how much privacy technologies can be really effective, but we can accept it as a good hypothesis. So the more you protect yourself, the less the expected cost. However, what is the problem here? That, well, economists would take the sum of the two costs and try to find the point of minimum cost, and that's where the point where they decide to behave. So at the point, they will decide the kind of level of privacy protection. Not too little, not too much. However, for us, actually, it turns out that we go back to the psychological distortions. Although a rational consumer sees the expected cost, most of us normally consider what is the minimum and the maximum risk we are facing. The minimum risk in the case you don't protect yourself could still be zero, because you can get lucky. You don't do anything to protect your privacy, and nothing bad happens to you. So you could be in that space and still have no cost whatsoever. On the other side, and this is a huge problem, even when you try to protect yourself from almost everything, you can still fall somewhere for some reason that you couldn't control at all. So the more the cost goes up to protect your privacy, the less you really can say that you eliminate the risk of being subject to identity theft. So what happens is that when a non-completely rational user, idealistically rational, but a normal individual user or consumer like us, consider what to do, the sum of the two curves they consider is not the one on top, but it is the dotted line, which means that it is a kind of a rational, ignorant behavior to choose the minimum level of privacy protection, because you could still get away with that. So it's what I could call rational ignorance, in the sense that you expect that even if you protect yourself, well, you may not be better off, so you choose not to protect yourself. So this is the theory, this is the modeling. The very last part, probably the last 10 minutes of the talk, is about some empirical validation or not of what I've been telling you so far. So I'm in the middle of this quite huge survey slash experiment. It started first in May with a small pilot. Then we had a phase two with around 120 subjects and 100 questions. And this was paid by the CMU Berkman Fund. And then the phase three will be in fall with a larger sample and an attached behavioral experiment. But the phase I'm discussing now, I have preliminary data, so it's not that, it is a little rough, but still quite interesting. Focuses on privacy attitudes, behavior, and on market characteristics and psychological distortions. So starts to address some of the issues I've been discussing so far. The kind of questions we ask in the surveys were, apart from the demographics, we ask about how our sample subjects were knowledgeable about privacy risk, how knowledgeable they were about protection, did they know about the tools, what were the attitudes generically toward privacy and specifically in certain scenarios, whether they were risk neutral or they loved the risk or they hated the risk, whether they had a strategic or non-strategic behavior in economic terms, whether they had hyperbolic discounting, the kind of discounting I was mentioning earlier, and whether the buy and sell value for the same piece of information was the same, and whether their past behavior could tell anything about them so far. The demographic. We had subjects from 19 years old up to 55. The average was 24. Most of them were college educated. So in a way, our sample is biased towards skilled individuals, which makes some of our results even more surprising. The income, we had everything from less than 15K a year students to about 120K, mostly American, but not only, and mostly students, around 40%, but not only. Many were employed, some were unemployed. First of all, we worked, this is sort of the summary. We worked clusters, statistical analysis to create clusters to see which were the group, the clustering of people under various definitions. We find out that there were, again, for what concerns privacy attitude, the privacy fundamentalists, a small group, 2 million groups very concerned either with online or offline identity, and then a large group with low concern, a small group with low concerns. In terms of self-reported behavior, we found that there was a large group with a high degree of information revelation, and a very small group which reveal little and expose little of their own personal information. About knowledge of privacy risk, there were three groups, the dominant one being the highly unaware of privacy risk. And in terms of knowledge of privacy protection, against the largest cluster was of those unaware. And I'm going to show you some of these specific results summarized here now. First of all, attitudes. Well, we find here the same result that almost every survey about privacy has found from 2001 till today. When you ask, is privacy important for you, almost everybody says yes. So we have this nicely decreasing curve, very important, and fewer people, yeah, pretty important, somewhat important, very few say no, or nobody says not important at all. We got the same values when we ask, do you think you have enough privacy? Do you think you have more or less privacy than 1 year ago? Are you concerned about threats? And then we started asking things about how much do you know about how your information could be used. So do you think that the information you reveal to a merchant could be used to vary price during your next purchase? Only 14%, only around 26% thought that it was very or quite likely. Most of the people thought it was not that likely, while it is what happens regularly with discounts or coupons or price discrimination. Instead, almost everybody thought that knew that information could be used for marketing purposes. This, by the way, actually just a snapshot, because we had more than 100 questions. Obviously, I cannot show all of them, so I just try to show some highlights. Like this one. Do you think that the third party could monitor some aspects of your communication or your activities when, for example, you use a file sharing client, Kazaa? Well, most of the people thought that it was very, very likely or quite likely. But when you ask, well, what about in your organization you are writing a memo to yourself and this computer is attached to the internet or the intranet of your organization? Well, the question here was theoretical. Do you think that it is conceivable that somebody could monitor? And I would say that it's quite surprising for an audience like this to see that many people don't even think it's possible to monitor this kind of communication. Do you know what Echelon or Carnival Total Information Awareness is? Surprisingly, the vast majority of our sample did not even know what this program stands for, and therefore didn't know the risk. Or even more surprisingly, and this is very interesting. This is a very interesting result, because it's odd. It says, have you have completed a credit card purchase with an online merchant? Besides you and the merchant website, who has data about parts of your transaction? Many people said nobody. Then some people said the obvious answer, credit card company. Some others say hackers. And then we often had a question or answer similar to this one, say nobody assuming an SSL transaction, without which I would not commit an online transaction using my credit card, which confuses security with privacy, obviously. So you may ask, how is it possible that people don't even think about obvious things like credit card company, bank, issuing the statement that you read in that moment? Well, again, this is a behavioral problem here. It means that, of course, we ask the same question later on, adding more information, and we saw that people said, oh, yes, of course, also that party. But aware in the moment when we are asking, without prying in the subject, that information doesn't come out. Why is this important? Because you can argue that at the moment of deciding whether to protect yourself or not, sometimes you don't realize how many parties could have access to that person's information. So this answer, in a way, mirror the kind of flawed mental process we go through sometimes when we have to deal with privacy risk and privacy protection. We had evidence of overconfidence, which means that people not only were wrong about knowledge or risk, in this case identity theft, but they were even overconfident on that. They were wrong in a very bad way, in the sense that given the possibility of being more careful about the estimate, they would still be overconfident about their wrong estimate. However, people were more concerned about bundling offline identity with other data, so the high concern group raises when you bundle offline data. But when asked about, do you know, can you quote any privacy law? 54% could quote any law, not even say a Patriot Act. Does the OECD contain a fair information principle that you can litigate against wrongful behavior, which is obviously bogus? 38% believe yes, this is part of the OECD principles. You want to browse anonymously, what can you do? 51% couldn't come up with any answer. The same when we ask, do you want to say you want to send email anonymously, how can you do that? Most of the people didn't know anyway. You want to browse the internet and have warnings if a website is an incompatible privacy policy. 67% wouldn't know what we were talking about, and most of the people were using Internet Explorer, which has a built-in P3P. We also found evidence of what I was mentioning earlier, the economic traits such as hyperbolic discounting, what I was mentioning earlier, risk, strong risk aversion. People are strong averse when they don't like taking risk, even though in a pure mathematical perspective it would make sense, and non-strategic, non-rational behavior through some of you may know as a beauty contest game. And then we find out, okay, have you ever used any strategy to protect your own privacy? So let's take it in a very general sense, not only a technology, but something like stopping a purchase because you didn't want to reveal data, or maybe giving away fake data. And we found out that, in fact, 74% of the people did use some approach. This is interesting because when you go down into specific technologies, we ask, do you use encryption? Do you use shadows, do you use do not call list, do you use caller IDs? Well, the percentages go down. Only between 8% to 15% to 20% of people use encryption or use shadows or use do not call list. 75% of the people use at least one of them. So what is the point here again? We go back to what I was mentioning earlier when I have the chart with the big picture. Some of us protect ourselves in certain situations. A few of us try to protect ourselves always, but most of us cannot spend all the time in protecting ourselves from any possible privacy intrusion. So some of us believe that shredding document is more important than a do not call list. Some other believe otherwise. The problem with privacy is that you never know where the attack could come from. So the one door you leave unchecked could be the one for which you're going to be attacked. And one of the last questions we asked was, okay, so then what do you think would be the best way to protect your privacy? And overwhelmingly supported was government through legislation. And then people said also each user by itself through technology, and very just one person say companies through self-regulation. Many people said everybody, in the sense that it has to be a collective effort, what Kenneth Loudon has called a co-regulative approach. Adam? No, people, exactly, people could choose more than one. So what is this last slide saying, and combined to what I've been talking so far, that I want to try to summarize. My bottom line is that there is some economic theory which could explain why, even if we are really honestly concerned about our privacy, we cannot protect ourselves, because it's such a huge problem, and we have a time inconsistency problem, lack of complete information, bounded rationality. So if you're honestly concerned, you may end up not using Anonymizer, not by the Freedom Zero Knowledge Network, not using Roger Dingleding Tor, just because you cannot spend your time constantly protecting yourself. You need somebody to do that for you, maybe. And the preliminary evidence we got from the survey, and I stress it's preliminary because I just got it a few weeks ago, so it's still a little rough, still is showing some preliminary support for this view. We do find evidence of overconfidence, incorrect assessment of past behavior, of the risk you take, incomplete knowledge about risk and protection, and the dichotomy between the value you assign to a piece of information when you sell it or when you want to protect it. So if the rationality model is not appropriate to describe privacy, but we have to fight with individual distortions, what are the implications? That's why, again, my provocation, the tagline of the title was that privacy is easier to protect than to sell. I'm not really implying that the technology people like people in this room build is easy to do at all. I'm just saying that the technology alone doesn't work. Economic history is full of great technologies which failed in the marketplace and were overridden by worse technologies, sadly. So self-regulation, relying on companies alone, cannot work either. Rely on the user, I believe, will not work either. We need economics to show what would ultimately be shared and what would ultimately be protected. And we need technology so that we can implement exactly this separation, this protection of online and offline identity. But we also need a legal system, a policy environment, which creates what economists call the incentives mechanism so that the technology which will be actually used and deployed. And thank you very much for your attention.
Would you expect this survey would have been different if it had been out of, what is it, Germany or China even?
Well, yes, because actually there are huge difference in privacy attitude and value of privacy across different countries. So in a way, this survey is biased towards American approach. Absolutely, and that is already creating lots of headaches. You may have heard about data processing done, for example, in India by certain medical companies, and then there was this privacy debate that people felt that it was not correct sending medical data, health data, to other countries which didn't have the same level of protection according to, say, health data of the United States, because this could be risky. Or even between the United States and the European Union, there is this problem that the European Union has this strong European directive, and which prevents European companies to transfer data with foreign companies which don't have the same standards. That's why a safe harbor kind of regulation had to be built in order not to stop completely the flow of data between American and European companies. Yes? I'm very glad to be here. Writing that in marketplace is the best way to sell privacy. The government Yeah, the that's a fantastic point, because it highlights this problem that also Palm Samson is talking about, the cost, the social cost of conflicting privacy policies, because maybe some people criticize the European approach because it's so overarching, which does not consider the possible good or negative implications of a specific sector. So my point about using economics to try to direct technology is not contrary to what Posner was saying in the 1980s Chicago School, but rather points out that the view in the 80s couldn't know that now we have technology, encryption, which can allow information to be revealed and privacy to be protected. We have cool technologies. Sometimes the law is not yet going in the direction of forcing the technology, and sometimes bad laws are being implemented, but this co-regulative approach, mixing economics, technology, and law, could work. Oh yeah, for example, yes. 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 For example, yes. For example, yes. And consider even the simpler case of anonymous payment system like eCash. When you go on Amazon, I never talk with Amazon top management, but I believe they don't really care to know that I'm Alessandro Acquisti. What they care to know is what my previous behavior online was, and what is my taste, what is my likelihood that if they target to me advertising for the new book by Tom Clancy, I will buy it or not. And that can be done anonymously, because I can log in with a Hotmail account, and I can pay with eCash. I don't think they really care about my real name. The problem is that current legacy system link together the data. And the frustrating thing for US technology is that we have really cool technology, we can unlink them, but it's difficult to make them work in the marketplace because the incentives are not there. That's why a policy legal system can create these incentives. Mark. I think that's a very good point, and I hope I try to say something on those lines when I talk about the anonymity sets and Sergeant Danese's work, in the sense that I believe that complete anonymity is impossible, because even when you use technology, you still are leaving trails that somebody with enough resources and time will be able to recollect. But my point using the shorthand expression unlink is to say, let's make that linking costly. We probably will never be able